It's TechBiter Worldwide with Bill Blinn. The latest on programs and policies, helpful hints, and a bit of occasional nonsense. All in more or less plain English.
Podcast number 905 for the 25th of October, 2024. This week, I talk about libraries frequently because they're probably the best value provided for your tax dollars. If you're looking for access to news media that are often behind a paywall, your local library may be able to help. In Short Circuits, continuing with the topic of locating reliable, honest, unbiased news sources in the days leading up to this year's presidential election, we'll take a look at 1440 News. And podcasts for the past 2 weeks were canceled because Phyllis and I were both dealing with COVID when I should have been preparing reports. You may already have had COVID, perhaps more than once. For us, it was our inaugural voyage. This isn't the first time I've talked about libraries, and it's likely not to be the last. That's because libraries have so many resources that are available without charge to patrons. Libraries have books, CDs, DVDs, and other media on offer, of course. Some also allow patrons to bring their files to the library or upload them to be printed, sometimes for free. You can borrow ebooks and audiobooks. Many offer access to other resources, and in fact, that is what today's report is all about. First, though, consider which libraries you can borrow materials from. Central Ohio is library-rich with 17 library systems that are part of a consortium. A library card from any one of those libraries provides access to all physical and digital resources owned or licensed by any of the library systems. This includes single-location libraries such as that in Grandview Heights and Bexley, to library systems with multiple locations such as Worthington Libraries and Upper Arlington Libraries, and all the way to the Columbus Metropolitan Library with its 22 branches. The consortium gives access to all Central Ohio libraries, including some outside Franklin County, but not the other large libraries in the state. Living in Central Ohio doesn't eliminate the opportunity to use digital resources from Cincinnati, Cleveland, Dayton, and Toledo. Any resident of Ohio can sign up for a card from each of those library systems. You're limited to using only digital resources unless you travel to the library and provide an ID with your address on it, and anything you check out from those distant libraries would have to be returned there. There are valid reasons for creating accounts at other libraries. An ebook that has a huge wait list in Central Ohio might be available faster, and sometimes immediately, in Cleveland, Cincinnati, Dayton, Toledo, or Belle Fountain. Yes, I have a library card in Logan County. As I've mentioned a time or ten, that's where I'm from, and in addition to being able to obtain some ebooks faster, having accounts at those alternate libraries may also provide access to some resources not available at your home library. Most libraries will have Libby for online ebooks and Hoopla for audio and video resources, but some offer newspaper and magazines, reference materials, research links, and database access. That's the best reason I can think of for joining all the libraries you can, both local and in state. In Ohio, most or maybe all libraries will enroll anyone who lives in the state. That isn't true everywhere, but it is worth checking wherever you live. Because all Central Ohio libraries are part of that consortium I mentioned that shares books and media, it's less important to have borrowing privileges from all of them. After all, a book or a CD that's owned by the London Public Library is available to anyone who is a member of any of the consortium libraries. But digital resources are different. Different libraries provide access to some online resources that might not be available from the others. I have a chart that shows some of the resources that are available at some of the libraries. The chart is not complete, and where I have indicated that a particular resource is available at a particular library, it means only that the resource is available at that library, not that it is unavailable elsewhere. Britannica, for example, is generally available, but the Cincinnati Enquirer is available only in Cincinnati. The Toledo Blade, available only in Toledo. Cleveland highlights Morningstar Investments, although it may be available from other library systems. Cleveland is simply where I encountered it first. The Logan County Library in Belle Fountain provided access to Ohio's driving test information, and of course that may be available from other libraries too. Libraries within easy driving distance also host community events, workshops, and programs. By having cards from multiple libraries, you can participate in a broader range of activities. I've already mentioned why I have access to ebooks at the state's larger libraries. Ebooks and audiobooks may be available sooner from a library that isn't your primary library. For physical books and media, interlibrary loan services may be helpful. These interlibrary loan agreements vary from one library to another, and you may be able to obtain a rare book that's not available directly from any of your local libraries by using the statewide system. Signing up for multiple library cards can help libraries, too. Funding often depends on the number of members the library has, and more members means better funding, so libraries can maintain their services. I'm sure you already know how much importance I place on Benjamin Franklin's invention. In 1727, he established Junto in Philadelphia. It was a discussion group that sought mutual improvement through intellectual dialogue. It was also known as the Leather Apron Club. Books were rare and expensive at the time, but Franklin had an idea. He created the Library Company of Philadelphia in 1731. There was a subscription fee. The Library Company eventually allowed non-shareholders to borrow books, but it required a deposit for loaned books. By 1800, there were more than 40 lending libraries throughout the United States. That number has grown quite a bit since 1800, and today libraries are supported by taxpayers. There are few better investments. If you find these podcasts useful, and I hope you do, might you consider a donation? There are no ads here, and support from listeners is the sole source of income. It's easy. Just visit the website and click the donate button near the top of any page. You can make a one-time donation or schedule a repeating donation every month. I thank you. And so does the cat. In short circuits, anyone who's old enough to remember when AM radio was king might think 1440 Daily News Digest is some sort of radio station site. It's not, although 1440 would be a valid frequency in the United States. 1440 is one of what broadcasters refer to as graveyard frequencies that often had more than 100 stations assigned to them, most of them low power, directional, or daylight operation only, sometimes all three. The stations on 1440 are mainly Class B, C, and D stations. Well, if you're expecting me to take a diversion to explain what Class A, B, C, and D stations are, according to the Federal Communications Commission, you're right. Class A stations can broadcast 24 hours a day with 10 to 50 kilowatts of power. These are the stations that can be heard across multiple states. Class B stations can broadcast 24 hours a day with 250 watts to 50 kilowatts. Many have specific nighttime restrictions. Class C stations, well, they're intended to provide local coverage only and may be limited to daytime operation with a maximum power of 1 kilowatt. Many reduce power to 250 watts at night, some to just 100 watts, less than a light bulb. And Class D stations can be licensed to operate daytime, limited time, or unlimited time, with a nighttime power of less than 250 watts. A few are permitted to operate at 50 kilowatts during daylight hours. But once again, I have gone off the track by quite a bit. In fact, the name has nothing to do with radio frequencies, so I've just wasted a bit of your time by dragging you down that rabbit hole. The name refers to the year the printing press was invented, but that may not be entirely accurate, because the printing press was probably invented in 1438, not 1440. As Maxwell Smart would have said in the old Get Smart TV series, missed it by that much. Well, there's more. Multiply 60 by 24 and you'll get 1440. That's the number of minutes in a day, and the 1440 Daily Digest says it wants to help people make each minute count by delivering concise, factual, unbiased news. It's a free service that's supported by ads, and you receive one email each day with a news summary. They've been around for about 5 years now, and if you don't want to sign up for the newsletter, you can read the Daily Digest on the website. The fact that it's free tells us one thing. We are the product. Our eyeballs are being sold to advertisers. But that is, after all, the American way. It's how newspapers, radio, and television work, even NPR and PBS. During the pledge breaks, we hear about the importance of donations from listeners and viewers. Those donations are critical, of course. But businesses and organizations that underwrite programs are described on air in what sounds an awful lot like commercials. Still, 1440 News receives high ratings from Media Bias Fact Check. There are two primary criteria: bias, that describes political leaning left or right, and credibility, that describes the accuracy of the information. The best possible rating would be least biased and a high factual reporting. 1440 is rated as least biased and high factual reporting, one step down from the top. You'll see a chart on the TechBiter Worldwide website that shows the Media Bias Fact Check's reference for a number of well-known news media. Now, I see nothing wrong with consuming reports from organizations with a left or a right bias, or even from those that have low factuality ratings, so long as you understand that there may be errors, omissions, and distortions that are not intended to be truthful. If you're seeking truth and not just your own bias confirmation, it is essential to consider multiple points of view. 1440 News does little or none of its own reporting, instead choosing to select well-written articles from news organizations that are less biased and more accurate. Some of the sources referenced recently include the Associated Press, British Broadcasting Corporation, CBS News, CNBC, India Today, London Daily Mail, National Aeronautics and Space Administration, Nature, Science Alert, Stanford University, TechCrunch, The Atlantic, The Wall Street Journal, Variety, and a lot more. If there's one significant concern I have about 1440 News, it's this. There is virtually no differentiation between editorial content and ads. Ads are preceded by a small, tiny, actually, line of text that starts with, "in partnership with." That, I think, is an insufficient distinction. The daily emails themselves are brief and cover just the most visible events. The breadth and depth cannot be compared to what's found in the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, Christian Science Monitor, or even national and international news section of a big city newspaper. That doesn't mean it's useless. It's not, and it does provide a concise and fair summary of big stories. Following the links in the reports sometimes leads to a paywall. In some cases, readers can continue by accepting ads, and if not, reading more may require a subscription to the source site. 1440 News is a decent addition to whatever source you use now for news, particularly if your go-to source is one that's in the more biased spectrum or one that sometimes plays a bit loose with the truth. If you'd like more information or to sign up for the daily email, visit the News 1440 website. You'll find a link to it on the TechBiter Worldwide website, www.techbiter.com. Well, it finally happened. Phyllis and I both contracted COVID. Back in October 2021, a lot of scientists were trying to work out what some people were calling the end game for COVID. We were still uppercasing the word COVID back then, and it was becoming increasingly clear to scientists that there was no end game. If we can develop vaccines that all but eliminate diseases such as smallpox and polio, why can't we do it for COVID? Well, that's a reasonable question, and the answer simply involves mutation. The smallpox and polio viruses mutate very slowly. Influenza and cold viruses, on the other hand, mutate quickly. That's why we have the annual flu vaccines. So epidemiologists suggested that COVID probably would never be eliminated, but that it could be transitioned from a pandemic disease to an endemic disease with vaccines. In brief, pandemic refers to an outbreak that occurs over a wide geographic area and affects exceptionally high proportion of the population. Endemic refers to a disease that is constantly present but spreads at a stable rate. Everyone will probably be exposed to COVID at some time, but not everyone will get COVID. And that would be true even if vaccines were 100% effective, which they are not. There are lots of reasons for that. For COVID, it's largely because the virus keeps changing. In other cases, the individual's immune system reaction may be incomplete. We are not automatons that always react in exactly the same way to every stimulus. So, at best, the vaccines for a disease that mutates quickly give you favorable odds, but with no guarantees. On March 12, 2020, Ohio ordered all schools closed for at least 3 weeks. It turned out to be quite a bit longer. 4.5 years later, with 6 COVID vaccines in my arm and preparing to get a new one next month, I finally tested positive for COVID. That wasn't a surprise because Phyllis had tested positive on Tuesday. I tested positive a day later. An early test had a line indicating a positive result, maybe, but the line was so faint that I wasn't sure it was there. You'll see a photo on the TechBiter Worldwide website, and it is clearer in the photo than it was when I held the device in my hand, even under bright light. It could have been a defect in the display, so I considered the result to be negative at that time. The second test was definitive, though, so I notified my doctor. Phyllis and I both had televisit sessions with our primary care physicians. Neither doctor prescribed Paxlovid. When I spoke with my doctor, I explained that the symptoms seemed to be mild, and we went over my vaccination history, as well as some concerning interactions between that drug and 2 other medications that I'm taking, and the potential side effects. I spent the next couple of days coughing a lot, so much that I developed sore abdominal muscles. The coughing, while painful, eventually started being productive, as in expelling giant globules of gelatinous glumps. Sorry if that's entirely too much information. I could smell or taste absolutely nothing, but the feeling of being grungy finally got to me, and I took a shower. It had been 5 days by then, and I probably would have offended myself if I'd had a sense of smell. Vision changed a bit, but only for a day, requiring the use of reading glasses instead of computer glasses when I worked with the computer. I should have attorneys looking into the legality of doing that. Well, anyway, meanwhile, I slept almost as much as Holly Gat, who tolerates the coughing, but flees when I sneeze. One evening, as I was lying in bed reading, my feet decided to perform a dance, totally uncontrollable spasming. It felt like it went on for an hour, but it was probably more like 90 seconds. So then I learned a new word, myoclonus, which is related to hiccups. Myoclonus can be caused by an infection, according to the Mayo Clinic. Since this has never happened before, and I clearly had an infection, I filed it under odd stuff that sometimes happens. Throughout the ordeal, Phyllis managed to keep preparing meals and washing dishes and doing the laundry, illustrating once again that women are stronger than men. As COVID goes, mine should be considered little more than an interesting experience. Certainly it wasn't a severe case, no hospitalization, no ventilator, no oxygen. It's clear that 6 immunizations did their jobs, and while they didn't completely prevent the infection, they did prevent a serious and possibly life-threatening infection. A week after the first symptoms and only 4 days after the positive test result, my temperature was back to normal. Uncontrollable coughing was a bit diminished, although it has continued for several weeks. Muscle aches were gone, except for abdominal soreness caused by the coughing, and even that pain was subsiding. In other words, I was feeling pretty much human by then, just a bit tired. All that remained at that point was a sore throat, the inability to smell anything, the inability to taste much of anything, and a lot of coughing. So I consider that a win for vaccination. Trust the science. And before ending today, I'd like to suggest that you visit the TechBiter Worldwide website if you haven't. Scroll all the way down to the bottom and you'll see an article entitled The End of an Era. Rick Altman has been doing in-person conferences for 35 years. The one that ended this week is the final in-person conference. Check it out. Thanks for listening to TechBiter Worldwide. I'm Bill Blinn. There's more on the website, techbiter.com, and if you have a question or a comment, use the contact link you'll find there. Stop by again next week for another session.